I gather you share some of that.
Okay, I'm interviewing Phyllis Tyler on October 10, 1988 in her home in Raleigh, North Carolina. She has now moved to Baltimore, and we were led to you by Ms. Vivian Irving. And I don't have the same kinds of questions that I would ask others about the communities, but I guess I would just start by asking you, well, when you moved to Raleigh?
In 1952.
You moved here in 1952? Mm-hmm. What brought you here?
My husband joined the new stream sanitation committee. He was, when it was first formed, he was an environmental scientist.
Oh. And he is Lloyd?
Lloyd Tyler.
Lloyd Tyler. He's an environmental scientist.
Mm-hmm. He trained as a chemist.
And he worked with the...
He worked with, it's now called, it's now, I don't remember the name, they changed the name a number of times. It's, but he has worked from the beginning of that, except for years when we moved to Gaza, part of the American Council.
Now, I had a note that you were, that you were a friend, and I'm, do I understand correctly that as part of your church-related activities that you became involved with civil rights movement, or
no? I think we've always been involved. We're my the tomorrow night, in fact, the ACLU is providing an award which we don't deserve. But I don't know why they're doing it. But I can remember as a child, as when I was 14 years old, picketing my father's mines with the 21 and Star Union in northern Minnesota. At the same time, Lloyd was down there. His father was voting for death, but he was in prison for Norman Powell the sixth time. So it's sort of something that's innate in both of us, I guess.
But you were picketing your
my
father?
My father was a ran mines in northern Minnesota. And when the IWW came in, it was the end of the world. Except that it wasn't. I thought that they needed to have some courage. It was based, at that time, said it was adolescent rebellion, and it probably was.
Oh, at that time, well, you said you were 14.
Yes.
And you were picketing your father's mines in northern Minnesota. That's funny. We just had, in Arizona before, I guess I was there on vacation, I saw an interview with a wobbly from the mines there, and I just thought it was really interesting.
Oh, yes, it was a hard night. Yeah.
I think so. And the mines are the copper, big open
iron mine.
So you said that was
I
the
guess
first
it's been, no, it's been in our blood, I guess. I became interested because of this, or the neat characteristic, in what other people were doing, and I investigated the Quakers and joined the Quakers and met my husband actually at the Quaker meeting in Minneapolis.
In Minneapolis?
I trained as a social worker and worked with family service in Minneapolis.
And so did you join the Quakers?
I joined the Quakers independently of having known my husband, which okay. I didn't just join the Quakers.
So, okay, but that's where you met your husband?
Yes.
And so then after you married then, and you came to Raleigh primarily because of your husband's job?
No, there was a period in there, there was a period of years when young people were involved in what they called the blessed community, I guess. The idea that if people got together and worked together, they could change the world. So we were members of several of those. One of them is in Cecil, North Carolina.
In North Carolina?
Cecil, North Carolina, in the mountains of North Carolina.
Oh, I've never heard of it. Would you spell the name for me?
CELO, near Burnsville. And we came there with our friend Harry Abramson, who is a chemist, and with whom Lord worked in Chicago for the National Cooperative. We bought land there and lived there 5 years. But it was very difficult to make a living. And we had three children by that time. So then when this job opened up in Raleigh and we needed a chemist, Lloyd came.
I see. So you lived there for 5 years, mm-hmm. and tried to make it go, was it a community?
It was a community in which the land was owned in common. And again, they really didn't accept us. Most of us were Yankees. And because we were also pacifists, people had come from prison and from civilian public service camps to see. We were certainly odd.
But pacifists, we're talking of time period right after World War II.
Yes.
And
they had been pacifists in World War II, therefore they'd gone to prison.
That was not very popular.
Oh, heavens no. And are there just wars? When you decide there are just wars, then you're over a hump. You're overgrown. And I guess those people decided there were no just wars.
I think that would have, in some ways, I was active in the anti-war movement against Vietnam.
Oh, yes.
I think it must have been so much easier. I think it must have been very difficult for people to pass
it. It was, because everybody was, it was a fight they felt to save their country, and they would be impressed.
It's funny, it seems that people forget.
Yes.
They forget we really have a long heritage of anti-draft and, World War I and that sort of thing, but World War II, in some ways, negated that history. So it must have been difficult. I think you said your husband was a chemist, mm-hmm. and so many scientists were involved in the bomb.
Mm-hmm.
It must have been difficult for him as well to find
it. It was
very difficult.
Like
so you were in, did the community have a name in CeeLo?
It was just called CeeLo Community.
CeeLo Community?
It was, the land was bought by Arthur Morgan, the PDA thing. And he bought the whole valley, of which he said it was the most beautiful valley in the world. And it was a lovely valley. It's changed sadly since.
How has it changed sadly?
And developers have come in, golf courses, and trees were cut down. There was just the fact that there was so much building that the beautiful trees, a lot of them died. It's a lot of lumbering.
Where is it near?
It's near Burnsville. It's in the, it's still there, it still exists. And people come and stay a little while. Mostly artists now, doctors who can afford it. You can always find a way to make a living. Potters.
Is there anything there reminiscent of the time that you were living there in the community?
Oh, it's exactly the same.
It's the same?
Yes. The fact that the community owns the land, it doesn't sell it outright, means that it's intact. That is
okay, so people are still living there as part of the CeeLo community. But you folks decided that you needed to move to Raleigh.
Yes, it was very difficult because we all came, it was sort of a time of healing at first, with people coming out of prison. But we discovered that the world came with us, and it was hard to, well, it's any community where people are living very close together and much interdependence exists, so it is hard. I say it's hard, it was wonderful, and I'm using that word.
It's interesting. My son is just hey, how that goes. Well, that was interesting. I'm getting back
to Raleigh.
You moved to Raleigh in 1952. It must have been much different than it is today.
We actually moved into the city of Raleigh in 1954. Our son. And that youngest son was born in Raleigh.
So you lived on the outskirts?
We lived in what is now New Hope Road, on Disney. And at one point we lived on a farm in Bankville.
Oh!
So we were trying to buy a house and then we bought this house.
So you bought this house in 54?
In 55.
In 55?
We came into it. And it was during the golden age education in Raleigh. Groton High School was wonderful. And the children had great teachers, some of whom are still in the classroom.
At Groton High School. Did all of your children go to Bowling?
No. Actually, oh, this is such a long story, and I hope it isn't all burned down, but we were so oppressed by the KKK, that is, particularly with our youngest son, we had to get him out of Bowling. He was a protester for the Vietnam War, and had started the draft resistance movement in Groton. And one night, he was coming home from school, the KKK came in with masks and beat him up. It was scary. At that time, I was working with the juvenile court. I was the director. And I was just frantic. He came home in terrible shape. And one of the counselors came in about midnight and said, get him up. And I said, wait, I don't want to get him up. He said, get him up. We have to tell him how to survive. These were two black men. They said when they had been young, one of them had come from an affluent family. And he said, he learned how to talk to people outside. Never going around a corner without wearing clothes on the other side. Never going to any place without a friend with him. Not even in school or in high school. And they alerted, for the rest of that year, they alerted the janitors and brought me. And Jonathan said it was so embarrassing to see them watching. They looked after him.
He was a student at that time.
He was a junior. He was a sophomore.
He was a sophomore organizing a draft resistance at Groton High School. Yeah. What year was that?
Well, he was probably 15, 54, 15. That was probably in the early 60s.
Early 60s. Mm-hmm. I'm assuming late 60s?
Yes, 54 and 54.
Yeah, he's younger than I am, so yeah. He's same age as my husband.
So we investigated friends' boarding schools, and they said, oh, you can't count on anything. You hadn't applied 10 years ago. But they took him immediately, and all of them. So he went to Westtown. His older brother had gone to Westtown School, because he very much wanted to, his brother Sam. But Jonathan went to Sam.
And so he went in his junior year?
He finished out his sophomore year here.
And
he went to Swarthmore College. No, he went for both years, junior and senior.
So we're talking, the KKK actually assaulted him on the steps of Groton High School in the late 60s.
And the thing that was so frustrating was I called the principal, and he said he got what was coming to him. He was organizing draft resistance for the war. He said, there's nothing we can do. So that was it. Our oldest son was he came home from Swarthmore at the time that the sit-in movement was going strong, and was the first white male to join them. And he was there, I think, for spring vacation. And in the night one time, the KKK called me. I was involved, I was gone. And said, we've got him. You know, you'll never see him again. Which I thought, I can't believe this. And I got up, not knowing what to do, and I was walking past his room, and he was in bed. So it's just a scare technique.
It's almost unbelievable.
I know it is.
I can't, when I
hear people say, well, things really aren't any better, I can't believe that they think that. Because it is better. These people are safe now.
I think that there is a renewed this renewed effort in the Aryan Nations and all of that kind of paramilitary of fascist activity,
yes.
You know, is there's a new resurgence of it. A lot of it's in the West,
mm-hmm.
And maybe that's what people are saying. Well, it hasn't changed. But
I think economically it hasn't changed that.
What do you mean,
people? Well, blacks are not making and not making $1 million a year as some whites are.
So you're saying that economically, you think the situation hasn't changed that much for black people, individual...
No, I think it's changed a lot. I think that I don't agree with people who say it hasn't changed that much.
As far as the prejudice...
As freedoms and prejudice, yes. A friend of ours was a young girl, Shaw, who and I had four children, who came to work for us. And then she got very sick. and was in St. Augustine Hospital. And I was not allowed to give her blood because I was, when she was black and I was white. So I think things have changed a lot.
When was that about? She was at Shaw?
She was at Shaw at the time of the sitting. Oh, this was before the sitting. Okay, she was. No, it says at the time of the sitting.
At the time of the sitting?
Just before, so a year before.
And what is that? 60?
62 or
62?
And Anne was the only white woman at the time. She was at Duke who went with the sitting in Durham. The university was very upset about it. They said, you must not ever walk home with a black, not because you're in that much danger, but the blacks are. If they're seeing it.
That must have been an awful. Yeah.
People would, they were concerned for her, and they tried to walk her to that university, and they were told not to get her alone.
It's hard for me to have an understanding of this because I didn't live here. I didn't have that experience in my own life, where I was growing up. It's almost like something from another time. So mm-hmm. I think it must have changed.
I'm sure it has, yeah.
We don't have the same thing, and yet then we have people being shot in La Marche and in Greensboro. So these things do come back to haunt
you.
It seems like some of the things that you're telling me is that your life, your home life, your life with your children and your family must have been very much involved in the civil rights movement were going on. How did that come about, or was this always a part of your life?
It's always been. I think that develops from the interest in the community and from the Quaker meeting. But I think our first effort, through the United Church, where the Quakers were absorbing the United Church when we came. And the Institute of Religion here brought Martin Luther King to speak.
Tell me something about the Institute of Religion. I've heard it mentioned several times, but I don't know.
It was the only forum that, there was a time when there wasn't much going on.
And we're talking about 50s, 60s?
Late 50s, early 60s.
Okay.
They brought speakers from, they brought Humphrey, they brought Martin Luther King here. They would set a theme for the year, and then there would be three or four speakers.
Okay.
I was on the executive committee for that one year. And that was an exciting thing. But
what was it from? The Institute of Religion, what was it a part of?
It was a program that was one of the main events for the United Church year.
Okay.
But our printing was done by the Irving Press. So I knew Vivian Irving from that. And I'm not just sure how it started, but I think the first thing we did was integrate the League of Women Voters. There had been an order from headquarters that they were to be integrated. But Raleigh would hear nothing of it and paid no attention. And so Vivian took two of her friends and joined at great cost to herself, I think. She invited us to have a meeting at her house, and the president at that time, Nettie Irma Crawford, was in Sturin. Well, no, Sturin. Please don't say that I said this to her. She was chairman of the league, and she quit at that point. The league membership went down by half. But it's bad.
When Vivian
and her friends joined.
Do you know who her friends were?
I'm sorry. I'm ashamed to say that I don't know. I think they're none of them living now.
Mm-hmm.
But then we started other theaters, and the League of Christ was very much involved in the school. My part in all this has been so. It hasn't been like Sylvia Rubies, for instance, who sat on that school board, who sat as a representative from the school board for years. They made her stay outside. They actually had dinner meetings, so she couldn't go in until they decided everything occurred under the table. And then she was allowed to go in. She said she always wanted to call up college cottage to bear it. But he was inside, and he was listening to all the reasons why we can't integrate the school.
Sylvia Ruby, she was a blog woman?
No, her husband is, I don't know who his first name is, but he owned Land's Jewelry Store, and a lot of talk, you know, is a very influential woman in the synagogue in him.
Okay.
And the one out on the...
Was it on Strickland or something?
No, it's a name on it. Why can't I think of it? I'm sorry.
Temple
Bethor.
So she was a member of that, and why did she have to stay up and...
Well, they made rules. You know, people in power could say, well, nobody but school board members can come because we're having supper first, or lunch first.
But why was she going to the school board meetings?
Well, the League was serving as a kind of watchdog.
And she was part of the League of Women Voters.
She was a member. She went as the League representative.
She went as the League representative, okay. And how was Mr. Carnage involved?
He was a member of the school board.
He was a member of the school board.
The only black member. And she said, how can we do it? She never...
And they're having discussions about how they cannot integrate the school system with Mr. Carnage there as part of the...
Yes.
Was he a full voting member? And
yes, but one of seven. He had small chance.
Okay. Do you recall any of the reasons? What are the reasons that they couldn't integrate the school?
Well, it was too soon. People just couldn't understand it. You know, it takes time to do this. We finally found a wonderful way to reason around that. Some of the schools had courses. The black schools didn't have as many fine courses. And if a child wanted to take a course, say in Spanish, and couldn't get it in a black school, that was the only reason they finally decided they would come to us. So a black professor's two daughters, who are now doctors, needed a special science course and went into a college. Wonderful. That was a real
time. We have listed Murphy School as the first school desegregation of the first integration being Bill Campbell, and this is September, he's second grade, September of 1960. He enrolled in Murphy School downtown and went to the school. Do you recall that?
I remember at the time when it happened, but I didn't think it was the first thing. Someone else said he was.
But do you think that these two young women went to Broughton to take these science courses before that happened?
I'm not sure. I think it was probably simultaneous.
Okay.
It all happened all at once.
All at once?
Yes. Mm-hmm. He wasn't the first, I'm sure. I'm sure of that. But again, I'm sure someone could contradict me and be perfectly right. It's awkward.
There are different ways to see first.
I think that, forgive me, can I turn this again?
Sure. You remember going with Vivian Irving too?
Yes. She was a chance taker. But we went to all the theaters in Raleigh, and went to buy tickets. Of course, we were not allowed to. There were days where the theaters were about people on theaters for points. And the first time we cracked it was over at the Varsity Theater, which is no longer exists, over by State College.
The Varsity? It was by State?
It's just across the street from State. I don't think there's anything right now. But as we were waiting to get in, waiting to be rejected again, some rather important women came by who were Beth Crabtree and a friend of hers. And in front of this window, spoke to us warmly. I think they even hugged us, both of us. And we were let in. It was the first time.
So you and, was it just Vivian, you and Vivian at that time?
Mm-hmm.
You know, Vivian told me that she thought she was the first black woman, was the first to integrate in movie theater in Raleigh. And she laughed and said what she thought, or her recollection, I think, was that the girl who was taking the tickets, or whoever was taking the tickets, just didn't know how to tell her no, that she could go in.
Maybe it was Beth. I think it was Beth.
Beth Crabtree. And they came by and greeted you,
yes.
and that was seen.
They knew both of us right now.
So as far as you know, you were the first.
That was the first.
Was there any to-do made of
the... Of course not. It was silly. Some of these things were...
Do you remember the movie?
No.
That way. You're probably sitting through the whole movie just amazed at what had happened.
I remember someone, one that important black man saying, and I can't remember who it was, that he didn't see why his son was sitting in that Dime Store. Because even if they served him, he wouldn't have any money to buy it.
So what do you do after you're allowed in? Well, and those are the kinds of things I think, you know, when you're talking about economically, things haven't changed and whatnot. Sure, you're allowed to vote, but what about jobs? That's interesting. This this was all happening about the same time.
Oh, yes.
I know that there was a lot of, it was in the air.
It was exciting. It was really a wonderful time to live. We went to Washington. Vivian and I went to Washington and took one of our children. And it was a wonderful time to go. Now I think, I felt when I really walked on Martin Luther King's birthday that we were not welcome. Nobody spoke to us. And yet there was a real camaraderie between black and white in those days.
You mentioned in a letter to me that you thought that black and white people could be friends in a way that you don't think
it can be now.
Why is that?
I don't know. I really don't.
What's
the feeling?
I think
the rising of black consciousness that they may have. Maybe this is, and I think it's good that they have to be who they are on their own.
When I was talking earlier about black people owning property, having to get someone from the white community to sponsor them or to buy it for them, are you saying that it's not needed now or not necessary to have that, to make that connection?
No, I think because I lived through the break, and friends of ours who were teaching in black colleges, like Roosevelt College in Chicago, and were asked to leave because they were white. They just left. They can't talk about it yet. Oh. They thought that they had sacrificed so much, and suddenly they were not welcome anymore. I don't think that side has ever been explored. It's just that suddenly the blacks were militant and were, some of us thought, I think that was right. But it was hard on older people particularly.
And people who've been involved in that movement for a long time before it was popular, before it was the thing to do. That would probably be here.
The fact that I can't remember names is probably psychological. It was so painful at the time, and I just put it out of my mind. At the same time, recognizing that it was important.
You lived here in Raleigh up until this past year?
Up until July of this year. Mm-hmm. We lived here 33 years in this house.
I ask that because you're saying at this time that you're talking about in the late 50s and early 60s being an exciting time, being a time, people are taking risks, people like Vivian, she's going out there and putting herself on the line, going, you could have been arrested.
Oh, yes.
The both of you.
But I think it was much more dangerous for blacks. They were, somebody came in to organize a march one time from outside from the Friends meeting, from the Friends and American Friends of America. And he had very sharp orders. There was to be no hand-holding, it was just to be very, very disciplined. And no smoking, it was almost like walking like the city.
You have to be a good example.
Yes, and you had to dress. You couldn't go in your jeans and your dirty T-shirt. We really dressed up. It was so different from the Vietnam time, where everybody was relaxed.
That may have been part of it too. We not only want you to accept our beliefs, we want you to accept our appearance. And appearance was a whole part of that Vietnam thing. I truly believe that.
And I walk on that.
On the day first?
No, I'm really, I'm keeping a special grant in to build communities like this, as long as they were integrated. But we weren't trying to integrate it for, Lloyd was on a committee with five churches built it. But Lloyd was on a committee, and we tried so hard to get some points in, but you had to be very brave to be one of hundreds of families, one or two. And they left very soon. And there was a lot of resentment of their being here at all because blacks need housing so much worse. So that was an argument that was used to not worry about it being
included. In Memphis?
In the Ridge Park.
Ridge Park. Mm-hmm. I know, they have a, was it the United Church
United
that was
Church
involved in?
And two black churches and First Baptist.
On Wilmington?
Uh-huh. And a congregational church in Pullen. I don't remember the church.
And the United Church. Mm-hmm. A congregational church. And all on. And what you were trying to do there was?
The grant was given to build housing in a black area in which would be integrated.
Okay.
And we interviewed everybody that came in while they lived there. One of my jobs interviewed them. Hello.
I'm sorry to interrupt, but I'm going to have to take you. I'm going to take you to Ellen.
Oh, no, Bob. No. I'll just wash my hands off. Can you come back?
Are you heading downtown? When you leave?
Well, like I said, I don't know how to go about it exactly the right way because I haven't had formal training in the methodology.
Oh, okay.
I'm very interested in this project. So you were saying that a grant was given to build housing, and it would be integrated housing, mm-hmm. and this is Ridge Hall.
Ridge Park.
Ridge Park, mm-hmm. I'm sorry. Ridge Park, and this was the community housing there. But wasn't there also a daycare?
Yes, all of that, Method Daycare. It used to meet at Method, and then I moved to Pullen. The center started on that. Carolyn King from the United Church was one of the pioneers in that.
Is she related to Cyrus?
She's Cyrus.
She's
white.
She's white.
White.
Okay. But Margaret Rose Murray is running the daycare center in Method.
Is it back in Method now?
There is daycare. The Method daycare is an integrated daycare center there.
But isn't it wrapping out of Paul Church?
I don't
it
know.
It has the name Method. I think it's still on there.
This initial daycare center.
The initial one was in Method.
But it's moved to Poland. Oh, the one that Margaret Rose has there, I think the reason that, I have a friend whose children are going there, mm-hmm. and he wanted them to go to this integrated daycare. So at least there is one in there that's continuing that tradition. So, so you were involved in that with the United Church.
Yes.
Now you had said that the United Church had kind of absorbed the Friends community.
It had, and then. There was a time when we felt that we were losing our identity like the Cohens, so we had
okay.
to for our own meeting. It was fine, it worked very well while we had a meeting house, but when we lost that, it's kind of just dwindled out the meeting. It's made up of largely of people who come in to the university and then the membership of the council.
Yeah. Are the Friends meeting at the Women's Center on John
mm-hmm.
Street? But at this time, from what I hear from Vivian and other people on the committee, the United Church is very active in the civil rights movement.
Mm-hmm.
What kind of role did the church play in civil rights?
They had wonderful ministers who were always part of and I mean, they were the first person you called if you were black and had a job with white people. Gay Noise.
Gay Noise?
Gay Noise. Gaylord Noise. He now teaches at Yale.
Is that N-O-Y-E-S?
N-O-Y-C-E.
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay.
Gaylord, G-A-Y-L-O-R-D.
Mm-hmm. And other ministers that were?
Collins Kilburn was involved. He was a minister, yeah. Mm-hmm. And I believe before we came, there were others, but I don't know. They were involved with everything. They were the group of Christ that brought Martin Luther King.
When was the Martin Luther King? Do you recall about what
it was?
Time?
Right at the again. When were the when was the Alabama? Oh, it's awfully old. I can't remember.
it's not that I can't recall. I can't recall exactly. It seems like there were all these things happening at a certain
once,
time,
yeah.
and it's hard to pin them down to a particular year.
It was at that time when there was all this ferment, and it was exciting because people were so desperate that you could get into the hearing. There wasn't space. They had been moved over into the church basement.
Where did they bring him? Or where did he stay?
He spoke in the... Now, Lloyd and I disagree on this, so don't take it.
Okay.
I can't tell you. I think he spoke in the United Church, and they had broadcast his speech down in the basement, so he could hear it there, too. Lloyd thinks he spoke in Broughton out of time.
Huh, okay.
But I don't know.
Where is the United Church?
Well, it was on, it's torn down over here. It was an old, very old, beautiful church on, next to, it was on Hillsborough Street.
It was on Hillsborough, near the, is it Edenton Street?
Near
Edenton
Street.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And it's torn down now?
It's been, yes, for a while it existed as a black center. Our daughter said her wedding.
So, is the church, is the congregation still?
The congregation has moved
still
out to a different church.
Okay.
Size part of that congregation.
Okay.
Many old members of the churches.
Cyrus King and his wife.
Mm-hmm.
So the church still exists, the church, the congregation
yes.
still exists.
Yes.
Okay. And on United Church, if it absorbed the Friends meeting group here, Did it have other parts to it? I'm trying to figure out what kind of a church.
Well, Christian congregation, congregational Christian and Friends.
Okay.
And the Friends moved out. They were absorbed and they moved out away again. And I can't give you the answer.
Were there black members of the United Church?
No, what happened was that they just never attracted black members. So between that and the Congregational Christian Church in the black community, we worked out an exchange for 1 year. Our family and Susie Fine went to the black church for a year, and two families from that church went to the Congregational Christian Church for a year, but it didn't last. When the year was up, nobody else wanted to go. It was a very interesting year. Susie Fine stayed on for
Susie?
Dr. Fry, she taught German.
Fry?
F-R-E-U-N-D.
Okay. And so she and her family, or just...
She was a widow then.
Okay.
And her children were grown.
And you and your family,
yes.
You're like the exchange family.
Yes.
What church did you attend then?
It was the Congregational Church.
And where was the... Is it down on Bloodworth Street?
Yes, I think so. Is
it a stucco, a small stucco building on South Bloodworth Street?
I can't remember.
Mm-hmm. That's it. I think that a lot of people call it Pete Wilder's church. And I know it's a long time. I'm not sure. I'll have to look into it and see if that's Pete Wilder's
church.
Actually,
that time had a white minister.
Is that right? But a black congregation.
And then while we were there, the minister changed to a black minister. Very black.
And this is in the 60s. But you're telling me that this was a very exciting time. A lot of people must have seemed like things were changing. I mean, with the federal court rulings and different things that were little successes, I guess, all along, and you must have known that, you know, things were changing, something that was in the air. When did that end, or how did that end? How do you feel like it?
It ended with the, and I don't know when this started, it ended with the move of black home.
the feeling of camaraderie and that we're black and white together, then all of a sudden it is a, it's a black, more black militant.
It was, my best friends, I could say, were black. Vivian. And Vivian still is the only friend I've got.
So you mean you're living here and all your best friends were black?
I can't really say that, but my good friends were black.
Okay.
Many good friends were black.
And Vivian's the only one who remains?
Yes. Okay. And Wilma, but Wilma's the connection is quite different.
Did you feel rejected or by your friends or by some friends, or did they moved away from having white friends? Or
it's funny, it became the thing to do, and I think we could understand that, but we didn't feel rejected. We just felt that was what they needed to do.
So people made a conscious break.
Oh yes,
made a conscious break.
We didn't make it, but they did.
But they did. Mm-hmm.
And I think it was brought in upon us more forcefully the time of Martin Luther King's birthday in March. From where we used to start, at the Capitol, the old Capitol, down to the auditorium. And we walked the whole way without a single black person. That was a strange experience.
Martin Luther King's birthday?
Yes, in Raleigh.
When?
His last one.
His last one? So January of this year, 88?
Yes. Yes.
And you made? So you marching in remembrance of Martin Luther King's birthday, so you marched the whole way without, it was, there were other white people involved in the march, but.
No one spoke to me either. We were definitely segregated.
It was a segregated
And I
march.
Think it's fine, because I think they have to experience what they've experienced for centuries.
Still kind of sad though.
It is sad. Uh-huh. I think Vivian takes chances in being our friend. But Vivian always
So there's no reason to stop now.
Yeah.
I spend a lot of time at her house because her father is ill. We have meetings at her house.
Oh, uh-huh.
And I always tell her, you know, don't make things.
No,
don't make
no.
food. Or, she always has something really nice, and I feel like it must be draining on her, you know, to do that. But she has us there at her house. And
it's funny, but to talk about this now, it's suddenly one realizes that we were all risk takers, but Vivian took the greatest risk of all.
Why is that?
Well, I think she was always in danger. We used to worry about whether anyone would set fire to her.
Really?
But she was of a top level of black society, so I suppose she had protection. Didn't say Martin Luther King.
No. What about her father? Was her father active, or?
He was very active, very outspoken. But his children fought strictly. And again, not for quoting, but it embarrasses Vivian, I think, that her father is so. The great interest is in owning property, I guess it was.
Yeah. Black school teachers were paid more than white in the late 1800s.
Mm-hmm. $35 a month as opposed to $33 a month.
That's something. Well, how did you find that out?
From the direct city directory.
You found from the city directory of 1888.
That would be a very helpful book.
I think the architectural historian Rick Matson refers to this, and you know, city directory has the black school teachers making $35 a month.
I can't again.
Probably like it, but more black teachers are making more money. That's interesting.
And women black teachers make more. I suppose because there weren't that many educated black women to teach.
What do you see in? You see now with the black power movement, you saw that kind of coalition between black and whites really kind of break down, and do you think that's still, what do you see today? I mean, this is 1988. my son tells me, wonders why I'm doing this project. He said, there's no difference. Black people can vote and just the same as whites, and there's no difference. He sees no inequities or anything like that. There's nothing to get excited about. That's his opinion.
Interesting. I don't know, because I think you have to be black to know this, but it's true.
You were telling me that this may have had to happen, that black people needed to rely on themselves, and yet, I still feel from you that there's a kind of sadness that you're not part of that, or maybe can't be part of that.
Well, I don't think you ever can be part of something that's good. I think there's constant change. I don't know. A good friend of ours, Abraham Jones, for instance, lived on the street from us, and nobody cared. We had black guests, and we were ostracized. But he lived on the street. He's a lawyer and a very fine law firm. And he said that when he was at Harvard, his room, he was concerned about what was happening to blacks at that time around in the Harvard area when they were trying to have some kind of protest. And his roommate, who was in New York, a New York student from New York, said, what do you care about them? You're here. And that disturbed him no end. But I think there's more of a concern that they want to be. So often you're going to say it's economically we need to be better off. We're in bad shape. It's economically, but it's not a good one. I'm not there for her.
That's okay. I think that there are vast economic differences between black and white.
Of course there are.
And it's incredibly problematic for children